Byron FM.
Yeah, so good they named it twice, as I believe they once said about New York State in all sorts of ways. Professor Jane Chapman, a delight as ever to welcome you formally to the programme. And Gabriella, of course, was one of our students, the English School of English and Journalism. Now, of course, she's in Gibraltar. She's been with Gibraltar in broadcasting company, the GBC. She's now with the Gibraltar Chronicle and just continuing to thrive.
Right. I was in Gibraltar this year.
Oh, really?
Love
you
it.
Are.
Really nice. We did the climb, you know, to the top of the rock to see the monkeys. They're amazing.
The Barbary Oaks.
Yeah, and the views are just outstanding. I love the place.
You
I
should have
it's
dropped
great.
By Gabriella Peralta, our regular reporter there.
Yes.
Everybody's welcome. We've always had a whole sort of a routine from that perspective. Gabriella, the Gibraltar Chronicle, is that the only newspaper in Gibraltar, or are there others?
No, no. There's another one.
Oh, well, we won't talk about that then. So what?
But we have, I think it's like the second longest running newspaper, I think the Gibraltar Chronicle is, in the world, I think it is. It started in 1816, something like that.
See, that's why we appreciate Gabriella when she was one of our students and she was taking my module on reporting continuity and change, to have that historical perspective.
Absolutely. So it's a rival to the Times that is the longest, right? The Times of London.
Probably, I don't know. I know that was second longest. I couldn't remember who was first.
Right. Always good, yeah.
You didn't
we
expect
don't quite
to talk
make the longest,
history.
We're behind someone else.
Right. We'll be talking about Norwich and its sort of local newspaper packages, etc. But still, Gabriella, have you got any initial questions you'd like to put to Professor Jane Chapman?
Yeah, I've heard that you'll be doing, well, consulting in a Channel 5 show.
She's done her research.
Yes. In fact, I did the filming for it this week in London, but it's not going out until January. There's 2 one-hour programmes, and it's called Inside Buckingham Palace. And they're documentaries about inside Buckingham Palace. My contribution is to talk about the history of public relations. The palace have had lots of ups and downs over the years. If you remember Charles
Squidgy
and
Gate.
Diana. Yes, Squidgy Gate, Camilla Gate. In fact, the programme goes way back to the beginning of the 20th century, but my role was to talk about 1969 onwards. 1969, there was a disaster that I can tell you about later if you want.
Talking about that welcome to the family at Windsor and the Christmas sort of celebrations.
Well, it was the Queen barbecuing.
Yes.
It actually was seen by 38 million people. Oh. But considered,
I was one, I have
but
to say.
Did you know that Lord Attenborough felt it should never go out? Because what he said is, this sounds horribly, well, not racist, but strange these days. As an anthropologist, he said, it's like the chief in his hut, right? Once the chief comes out of his hut, you lose all respect. And, of course, what they were doing for the first time ever was showing the private life, we'll say the non-work life of the royal family.
She actually went into a newsagent and purchased a paper, if I recall, somewhere in Scotland.
Right. Well, the Palace have not allowed it to be shown since, and requests for purchase of archives on it are always turned down. And I think it's because they don't want to admit that it was actually a milestone in the way they handled their press relations.
It's intriguing because obviously Richard Fitzwilliams, who's coming out very shortly, has got lots to say about that as our official royal correspondent. So obviously another royal correspondent, Jane, you can sort of battle through on that basis.
Well, I was really wearing my hat of a newspaper and public relations historian.
I mean, in Gibraltar, Gabriella, from your own perspective, is it a case of, yes, massive support for the House of Windsor or less so? Or do you just think, no, we prefer the Spanish people?
Massive support. We actually recently had a petition to bring the Queen to Gibraltar because she hasn't visited in about 50 years.
Well,
right. Now, that would be
massive on royals.
Yeah, that would be very interesting because it would upset the Spanish.
Well,
yeah, that's why. And that's why she hasn't come in 50 years.
And the Spanish are very difficult when it comes to crossing the border. My only criticism of our day trip to Gibraltar was the getting over the border through the Spanish side was just a nightmare. They did not make it easy.
Okay. You've actually touched base on what Gabriella wrote her dissertation about.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I shall have to read it, Gabriella.
All interconnected in all sorts of ways. So in terms of a day in the life, are you a general reporter at the Gibraltar Chronicle? Are you? What sort of things have you covered so far?
Courts every morning.
Mm-hmm.
So I turn up to, we don't have a Crown Court in Gibraltar, we skip from Magistrates to Supreme. So I cover those two courts, and then in the afternoons, depends on what's on. Depends on how busy court is, if I have enough to last me the whole day, or I just go out and do interviews. And yeah, I do a mix of everything. I can write a feature one day, and then the next day being court, and it just changes every day.
So you
depends
have to
on where the news is.
You have to write up the court coverage very quickly then, Gabriella, because if you're there in the morning, you've then got to write it, haven't
yeah.
you?
Yeah. Yeah, court usually ends, well, now it's summer, so before 12 o'clock I'm done. So about, you know, we don't spend hours, it's about maybe 2 hours.
Oh, we would hope there's not too much crime in Gibraltar.
Yeah, that's why, you know, we have, you know, we do have, but we don't have, like, the past couple of days have been quite dead. Because August has hit.
Yes.
So I've been leaving court before 12 o'clock.
So how long would you have to write up the story?
I finish at 5, but I can finish at any time after that. So that gives me about 5 hours.
Yeah,
That's acres of time. I mean, good heavens, that's a quick calculation. Near 18,000 seconds to actually put things together. It's ridiculous.
A lot of them are quite short if they're magistrates.
Yes, yeah. Do you do speed writing or shorthand?
No, I haven't learned. I want to start learning.
Pre the NCTJ scenario was Gabrielle.
Yeah, yes. I actually was the last year before the NCTJ.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. So you managed to write it down quickly anyway.
Yeah.
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 It's all our months and years of experience on the Midweek Drive, actually. Yes. That's what sort of set her up for the whole thing.
Well, you see, journalists work quite hard when it's daily papers. That's why I was asking Gabriella. It's not easy.
On a day where, as we've said, it's A-level results day, and clearly we'll be speaking to a few folks who to talk about our views and thoughts on that. Any regrets about doing a university degree at the University of Lincoln and doing a degree in journalism, Gabriella?
No. No, none at all.
Nice answer.
Been lucky enough to work in my field, so I can't have any regrets.
So there we are. It's thumbs up from Gabriella Peralta, yeah. Our correspondent in Gibraltar, to work our way through that. Well, I think you know the last two questions. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme this morning?
Yes, of course.
And will you connect with us again in the very near future to update us on those Barbary apes and more from the Rock of Gibraltar?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, up in Edinburgh, as we approach Richard Fitzwilliams, it's the Band of the Black Watch on Siren 107.3 FM as it just approaches 10 past 8. Strangely stirring about the Band of the Black Watch with Scotch on the Rocks. What do you think, Professor Chapman?
I think it's great, yeah. It's kind of bouncy, cheerful for the first thing in the morning.
Bouncy, bouncy cheer. The sort of thing which will make you declare total independence. Isn't that right, Richard Fitzwilliams?
Well, I have to say that a visit to Edinburgh, and I was there last year as well, and at the same time when the festival opened, it's the sort of thing that really does make you think about this and hope that even if one day it's a sort of a federal structure, which it appears to be moving towards, who can tell, that in fact you don't have a totally independent Scotland, which a lot of people, I have to concede, do want.
Yeah, I agree entirely, Richard. And I think it would be an economic disaster for the Scots if they had total independence.
I think that the economic case is becoming increasingly significant with the fall in the price of oil. I think it would be economically absolutely shocking. I think it would be a very, very serious mistake. And if you see these countries, because obviously Scotland would remain part of the EU, or certainly apply to be, which, for example, like Greece or previously with Spain, Portugal, Ireland, where there were such serious financial problems, here you'd have a country recreating itself because particularly a large number of young people are very, very keen on this concept, but without any sort of sound economic basis for it, not to mention the fact that anyone with Scottish blood or anyone not resident there or who happens to have particular links, the emotional side, they wouldn't have a vote. If you, the voting was, and I noticed how this was handled, a very curious business, and also the fact that just 51% can get it. Oh, it's, there are so many aspects to what happened that I hope we can now learn from the problem.
Richard, just let Nicola Sturgeon have several more referendums until she gets it.
Oh, no. Definitely not. I disagree entirely.
Let us move on, because, of course, both Richard and Professor Jane Chapman, you've been on Location Report with us, of course, at the Comic Museum in London, which was the first time I think we introduced you formally to each other.
So that's right. You saw our exhibition, didn't you, with Comics and the World Wars contributed to at the Cartoon Museum.
Yes, I did, and I much enjoyed it.
Good.
But from thence, of course, the Channel 5 documentary, which is released next year,
Two documentaries,
Two
one-hours,
so.
A series.
And you did reveal something in the early part of the programme, Jane, which I wasn't aware that Buckingham Palace had actually put a ban on anybody accessing the 1969 documentary.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I mean, they wouldn't call it a ban, but although it was a great success in terms of viewings, it was deemed a failure in other ways.
Taking that line that you said at the time, David Attenborough had actually raised, was that rather like the Wizard of Oz syndrome, that ultimately you want to keep the magic behind the curtain? And if you reveal the
absolutely.
Magic, then suddenly think it's not the case at all.
That's right. His argument was you have to retain the mystique. Mm. The problem they had was with the rapid decline of Empire at the time in the 60s, they didn't know what to do instead in terms of their image. And the only thing available, really,
television
was
radio.
Beginning to be important. But I don't mean the dissemination of the image. I mean what messages to give out, what role. And family was an obvious one, wasn't it? But you see, once you start showing a personal life, you can't be selective. You can't control it in the same way. It has to be warts and all, and that is their problem. They've had
and
lots
then
of warts.
Murdoch, of course. I mean, this absolutely yes. what you're saying, I totally agree with, because after all, the 50s were so deferential, weren't they?
Yes.
You had the coronation, which is probably the grandest and most glorious royal spectacle ever staged in this country. And you also had in the 60s the questioning of absolutely everything. I mean, I think it would be fair to say that because of the investiture, which, even if it was historical nonsense, was extremely colourful, and because of the royal family, which, as you say, with the two viewings there were, with tremendously popular, replaced a Christmas broadcast in 1969, nothing like that has ever happened subsequently. I think the royal family emerged from the 1960s in a better shape than any other institutions, but all institutions, of course, took a battering. They felt they had to do something, and they seized on something that, as you say, let in rather much daylight.
That's right. They also had economic problems, or financial problems, in terms of them not being able to survive, so they claimed, on the civil list income, because there hadn't been an increase for a while, and the 60s had seen very bad in inflation. But there was also in 71, the House of Commons stepped in to on the civil list and made the Queen kind of defend her role and what she was doing for the first time, and that was an interesting departure as well.
Yes, it most certainly was, but she had, of course, a great supporter in Harold Wilson, and, of course, the little doubt that, Heath's period in office, Heath and the Queen, I think, didn't always see eye to eye. One remembers the famous occasion when she was advised not to go to the Commonwealth Heads of Government in Singapore, but no question there that she had important political friends, and although there were critics, the cost issue was deferred for 20 years, though we know, of course, subsequently what happened in 1992, which
yes.
made things appear so disastrous. But the actual royal family, I remember in South Africa we saw it, and I mean, we thought it was absolutely charming and marvellous. It's interesting that clips of it are hidden to the extent where the last, I think it was to commemorate the Diamond Jubilee, there was an exhibition, and I went to a press conference at the National Portrait Gallery, and there they revealed that a very small number of clips would be shown during this exhibition from Royal Family. When it reached the National Portrait Gallery, because it had been in Scotland initially, there were absolutely none at all. So that just shows you how blanket the coverage has remained hidden and will so.
Yes. I mean, they have tried to remain very much in control of what comes out into the public. But, of course, there have been leaks, really, haven't there, in the wall. And Camilla Gate and Squidgy Gate and the phone tapping
and all
this. Oh, the
1990s. I mean, if one was to...
Disastrous.
I think three decades that the monarchy couldn't... would wish never to see again, the 1860s, of course, the Albert's death, Victoria's reclusiveness, the 1930s, 1936, the abdication, and, one, from beginning with 1992 and every single thing that you could conceive going wrong, to obviously the battles, the catastrophic briefings between the Prince and Princess of Wales against each other in the press.
It's
and also
the War of the Waleses, they called it.
It was. No, it was. And Camilla Gate, Squidgy Gate, a whole series. I mean, the Morton book was completely unprecedented. Diana, of course, not officially having direct access, simply doing it through a third party. And I mean,
I'll have you know, Richard, that was the first book I ever reviewed for BBC Humberside, actually, the Andrew Morton Princess Diana.
Well, what did you say at the time?
I mean, well, actually, it was a very quick read, because I actually was given it about 24 hours before we were due to do the review. And in its own way, I thought it was an interesting snapshot of a royal soap opera, really, that was sort of developing.
Well, it was certainly a war, because, subsequently, the prince hitting back through that. Jonathan Dimbleby did not always advise. Well, we had the book, which I waded through. I've got it here, in fact. It is a rather curious read, and the prince's reflections on his childhood and his parents were not popular. But when it came to television and admitting adultery on air, not to mention taking 20 years to clarify Defender of Faith, it really was disastrous. And then we had Diana fighting back with Panorama and the inevitable divorce, not to mention what happened subsequently.
But Martin Bashir and the response to "there were three of us in this marriage," what's not to appreciate about that? I mean, sure.
No doubt, an absolutely brilliant use of the soundbite, Queen of People's Hearts, but questioning the prince's ability to do the top job. I mean, that went too far.
It's beyond the pale.
Yes, I think it did. I mean, things have calmed down a lot now, haven't they? But it's not to say that we couldn't have another kind of royal drama in the future.
If we look at 1860s, 1930s, 1990s, probably around about 2030, 2040, that's the next time they're due for a major challenge.
I mean, the calculation will, I hope, be inaccurate, but one has to say that I do think when the Queen talked about lessons to be drawn, when she talked to the grandmother, to the nation, after the tragic death of Diana, and there's no question lessons were learnt, and subsequently I do think the royal family use social media tremendously well, and it makes, for example, the Christmas message also gets to so many more people in different ways through these, and when it comes to announcing important whether it's births, whether it's engagement.
Wasn't it nice that they still actually use a sheet of A4 paper and a kind of stand to actually sort of make that first announcement?
Oh, it's charming. It is released first, of course, through Twitter, because somebody between the time the royal official leaves the hospital, we do have to take account of the fact that things do get leaked. And I do think with the 8 years that it took to rehabilitate Camilla after Diana's death and subsequently the marriage in 2005, that was a PR exercise on a grand scale, and they did pull it off.
Yes, they did. It took a long time, but they're becoming a lot more professional. That's right.
And they were much appreciated when they attended the Great Yorkshire Show earlier this year, because we were there, and all was good. In fact, Sue Rice, a current MA Community Radio student, actually had words with Prince Charles. She commented on her hat.
Yes.
Just nice to see that's working through. So much to get through, Richard. We want to just move on a pace. Let's move on to Leith before we take a brief musical break here. And your time on the Royal Yacht Britannia, which is now, of course, moored in Leith.
It is indeed, and I do have to say that I approached this with very considerable trepidation because I had been on Britannia for a party some 20 years ago because my father knew the ship's surgeon, and I mean, obviously I only saw a small amount of it then, but it did seem to me a danger that it might be embalmed, it might well be terribly... a rather dead venue for tourists, and I do have to pay tribute to the way that they have handled this, because it really is tremendously impressive, and as you know, Zara Phillips and Mike Tindall had their party there, their reception when they married nearby, and there's absolutely no question that Britannia still is a very, very worthy place for such an event, because they've kept, insofar as it's possible to keep that which is a tourist attraction, the cachet, the uniqueness of it. One statistic I must mention, because everybody knows that Britannia from 1953 to 1997, 968 visits, way the Queen loved it so, and so forth. I was absolutely fascinated by this one statistic, which says an awful lot about Royal Yacht that 4.7 million visitors have seen, and which is part of a tradition dating to 1660. The Overseas Trade Board estimated that between 1991 and 1995, the commercial days on Britannia had brought in some £3 billion to the exchequer.
Yes, yeah. So how have they done it up then? Describe it to us, Richard.
Well, I can only say that it has been done up with a fudge shop in the centre, that is true, that, and also a variety of tea rooms and facilities nearby, but you actually enter it on three levels from the shore, which is extremely clever. So you enter the first set, and then the second, and then the third, and tour around seeing the various bedrooms and seeing the various facilities for the... whether it's the Royal Marines, who are pretty cramped, they do beating the retreat, or used to do, for guests on board. And also you see the state dining facilities, you see the laundries and the kitchens and so forth. But what absolutely fascinated me were the traditions on Britannia, because it was a yacht where the royal family relaxed. There were no shouted orders. It was all, the orders were all done by hand. Ratings didn't wear caps because if they were to salute, members of the royal family would have to salute back and so forth. The whole idea was that it would be relaxed. It was largely a ship that operated in silence. They have a 220 crew with an admiral and also 26 bandsmen for the Marines. And
yes, but Richard, they don't as yet have the Proclaimers there. Back with you very shortly. Sound of Sunshine on Leith with the Proclaimers. A little musical break there, because Richard, as I assure you appreciate, every so often we have to keep the pace of the breakfast show going, do we not, sir?
Most emphatically we do.
Exactly. Jane thought we were cutting you off too. We were being disrespectful there, so disrespect the Fitzwilliamsmeister. Jane.
Obviously with the Scottish Parliament to be admired.
Well, you say admired. I mean, we caught a little mention you'd made on social media of your presence in the Scottish Parliament. Is that fair to say you're not a fan of the architecture, Richard, are you?
Well, you have to bear in mind, of course, it's at the end of the Royal Mile, which is opposite Holyrood House Palace, and it's wonderful, it's beautiful, rather romantic, ruined abbey, and also the Queen's Gallery. And you have Eric Morales's brutalist architecture. He says that such a building should reflect the country that it governs. In my opinion, it very, very definitely does not. I mean, I do think the outside is hideous. You go on about the interesting exhibitions inside and a beautiful picture of the photograph of the Queen, which I have to say I did like, taken by Sean Murawski, and the three honours, which the Crown, Sword and the Mace of Scotland by Graham Stewart. It's an interesting sculpture inside, and a photographic exhibition, the World Press Photo winners, all of that. But that's inside. Outside, it is absolutely hideous, in my view. And it was, incidentally, I've got to say, it was supposed to cost £40 million. It cost £400 million.
It's the biggest waste
ever, I think, in our history.
Yeah, it has a very, very bad history.
I'm sure people will come to love it, folks.
Well, I don't think it blends in. I think he's absolutely right. It doesn't blend in with the surroundings and the cost. I mean, how they
can
explain
Scottish carbuncle, I do not know.
Yes, I think it's a Scottish carbuncle of exceedingly excessive bad cost.
I totally agree with you. A carbuncle is a very good description of it. I would have tweeted it had I thought of that.
Well, we should obviously have worked together. By the way, we have to pass on comments from our Los Angeles correspondent, Phil Leonis, who's still looking to actually write that joint top 10 list of all-time great spy films.
Indeed, yes. So I'm already thinking of them. You said him, the spy who came in
from
Sackle, the Ipswich
file.
Meanwhile,
my second favourite movie of the summer so far has to be Inside Out, which you believe might actually make an Oscar. It might even do Best Animated Picture. Do you not, Richard?
I very definitely do, because what's so interesting, Inside Out took such a long time to actually emerge, as it were. One uses the...
You can't hurry genius from the Pixar studios, Richard, for goodness
sakes. Pixar's done terribly well here, because you have Riley, a really happy kid who loves hockey. She's Midwestern, she's 11 years old, and what happens... Well, her parents decide to move to San Francisco. Now, any move is traumatic, but when you actually examine the emotions in someone's mind, which are the dominant emotions?
You've got joy. Obviously, you have joy, followed by anger, and then sadness. And it's
fear and disgust. Yes, but which predominate and how? And this is what is so intriguing about this movie. It's the joy is the voice of joy. I do have to give a special mention to, because Amy Poehler, absolutely marvellous, my co-host at the Globes. Joy after Ricky Gervais, we won't go there. But, I mean, I do have to say, it's very, very clever. And the psychology, the way they thought this through, how a child, for example, can become deeply unhappy and decide to leave home, and which emotions and in what way cause this to happen. It is amazingly clever. There's no doubt about it. The architecture of the mind, you could say, and something that is...
And no mention of Freud whatsoever, which is great. You know, so you've got the psychoanalysis without Freud. Genius.
How right you are. And directed, it has to be said, by Pete Docter, script and also Ronnie Del Carmen.
Yeah. And music by Michael Giacchino, which we're listening to in the background. Bundle of Joy. A wonderful movie, Jane. If you want a feel-good movie, I would say Inside Out. Worth seeing.
OK, when does it come to Lincoln? That's
question. It's already been out.
Right, okay. Sorry, I missed it.
Good
Sorry.
Heavens. Yes, and
in the same week as that, very much to recommend it, I have to say yet again, Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation. I was so impressed with this, because it proved improbable sequences can be tremendously exciting if they're well cut and well handled.
Exactly.
And the next Spectre should note...
Well, I'm just waiting to see The Man from U.N.C.L.E., directed by Guy Ritchie, which is, of course, released in a matter of hours from now, which is A-Level Results Day and the release of Guy Ritchie's Man from U.N.C.L.E. Amazing.
I prefer the original. Obviously, I haven't seen the new one, but
interesting.
A soft spot for the original.
David McCallum, very positive about the movie. Robert Vaughan hasn't seen it, less so, really.
Really?
So we don't know. And obviously, we don't know what Leo G. Carroll, the original Mr. Waverley, would have thought, because he's in Great Uncle in the Sky, basically.
I was in Scotland when the preview happened, so I haven't seen it yet, but I'll certainly be telling you next week.
I would have thought so, Richard. Don't worry, we'll have some musical stuff to get through. Very quickly, of course.
When it comes, I must briefly give a mention, because how could I not, to the festival in Edinburgh?
Exactly.
Really, this is so extraordinary. It's said that the population of something like 500,000 trebles during this period, and no wonder, given the amazing variety that there is, and so much talent. I've got to spot Giles Brandreth's word power, because he's really just a walking dictionary, and he's such a crowd pleaser. It's always absolutely delightful to see him and touch base with him briefly, because he's such a supporter of the Royal Society of Portrait Painters too. And Rebecca Vaughan created Elizabeth I. This was first acted at the festival in 2010. She took it up, and these are the words of Elizabeth and her emotions, and we can see what a deeply complex person she is. It's quite something, a tour de force for an individual in 1.25 hours, and some of it is rather on one note, but I have to say I was very, very impressed with it. Historically fascinating. Jurassic Park thrilled the audience, because it's a tribute not only to the film but also to the family. It's cleverly mimed, because a family are paying tribute to a lost loved one who adored Jurassic Park, and they examine their own relationship subsequently. There was Elf Lyons, the raunchy being Barbarella. She's
And yet, Richard, I noticed you didn't manage to check out one of our recommendations either. Anything from the University of Lincoln, of course, which was up there with the Lincoln Performing Arts Centre. Five different performances, quite rightly so. Richard, you went to see Jurassic Park instead.
Well, I have to say that given the way I was balancing it, the Daily David Bailey exhibition at the National Gallery, which I have to give a mention to, and also Lee Miller and Picasso and Lee Miller, a very, very interesting exhibition of photographs. They were friends for many years. They first met in the 30s. There's the famous photograph of them meeting in liberated Paris in 1944, and they were friends until Picasso's death in 1973. And this is, it's in the Scottish National Portrait Gallery, which has recently been reopened, and it's absolutely the way everything's restored.
Richard, so much to pack in. We're clearly going to have a second part of the Edinburgh adventure very shortly. Jane, would you like to ask those last two questions to Richard Fitzwilliams, please?
Well, I think this is a stupid question, so I'm not sure I want
to. Okay,
did you enjoy your time in Siren? I'm going to rephrase it.
I call it our standard survey, as in National Standard Survey.
Yes, but
NSS.
Nobody is ever going to say no.
Oh, it has been no.
So what's
Jane?
The point in asking it?
Jane, I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Good.
Lovely to touch base again. And
yes,
I hope we can chat again shortly.
I hope so, and I would love to hear more about Picasso and Lee Miller.
We will work through that. And just for you, from the movie The Man from U.N.C.L.E., directed by Guy Ritchie, Daniel Pemberton's Mission Rome. And of course they went on location in Rome to shoot part of the movie, so that augurs well, really. I mean, we can see Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kuryakin back in the days of the Cold War, admittedly portrayed by the interesting characters Armie Hammer as Ilya Kuryakin and Henry Cavill, who was born in Jersey, of course, and portrayed Superman as Napoleon Solo. So, that's from The Man from U.N.C.L.E. I don't know, Arthur McKenzie, are you in any way, shape or form a Man from U.N.C.L.E. fan, or was it a case of no when you were up in Newcastle as a lad before you joined the police service and became Detective Chief Inspector and became a UK discus champion thrower? Man from U.N.C.L.E. didn't cross your radar at all?
Oh, of course it did. Yeah, it was very much approved viewing.
Yeah, approved viewing.
Yeah.
Exactly. Thursday night, Saturdays. Do you remember The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. with Stephanie Powers?
No.
Ooh, no, I don't either.
You see, great pity, Stephanie Powers and Noel Harrison, who only ran for one season, but it was a much-loved season. We had four seasons of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and one season of The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. April Dancer was her name.
Right.
A bit of television history there, to actually
yes.
work through. Arthur, how's life in the joys of Newcastle?
It's not bad at all. Sun is shining. It's a nice day. And it's good to get up and know you're still here.
You see? And what better advice could you actually have for A-level results day than those very words? It is, of course, the time of the year where it seems the entire media world tends to go momentarily crazy on things such as falling standards, rising standards, better standards and all sorts of things. Sometimes I feel we need to just allow our youngsters time to relax and sort of take part, you know, just enjoy the success that they're actually getting. What do you think, Jane?
Yes, I mean, it's important at that age, just the general development, isn't it? Relationships and coming to terms with the world, and you know, it's not just exams.
Well, here's 20 seconds from our very own Jeff Thompson with his advice on exam day.
If your exam results are better or not as good as expected, you can ring the exam results helpline on 0808 100 8000. That's 0808 100 8000. Full contact details on facebook.com/SarenFM.
But I know the world is waiting, Arthur, for what advice you, as an ace televisual writer of The Bill and Wycliffe and creator of the fabulous movie character, I always get it mistaken with Harrigan?
Yes.
Harrigan, yes, Harrigan, exactly. What advice would you give to youngsters who might, or indeed their parents, who might be sort of, because the youngsters might have gone off to school already, like, you know, like our very own midweek drivette, Eva MacDonald, who, as well as being Miss Teen UK this year, is taking a year out before she goes in to do music, etc. Eva, I'm sure it'll be splendid. It'll be good results. In fact, we might try and reach you later on to find out how things are going. But what advice would you have, Arthur?
Well, it's not for me to give anybody advice, because when I left school, I didn't have any exams, and I never looked back, and I went along to the cemetery and did some bird's nesting. So
there you have it, you see.
So school for me was just a big, it was just a big mystery, the whole thing. I didn't educate myself till I was about 40.
Which yeah. is quite
so that... giving somebody advice, the best advice I would give anybody, I'll just do what you're best at and do the best you can with it.
Yeah, I think that coming to education later in life is great because you really want it then.
Exactly.
Yeah, so there is always a second chance, and it may come later. So it's not the end of the world when you're 16, 17 or 18, whenever.
I think... As well, sometimes we expect too much of kids. I think there's far too many exams, to be honest with you. I think that, and when I was at school, the classrooms were nearly 50 in a class, and they just taught to the top level. So people like me who are like hiding in the back, we never got any education at all. So I think that at the moment it's gone the other way. I think there's far too many exams. There's too much emphasis on exams instead of getting people to grow up and be people, be decent people, and teach them other things than how to, you know, use a calculator and do an iPad and all this stuff.
Do an iPad? That's an extraordinary line. I mean,
well, the thing is that I have to wrestle with this stuff now, and I do. I wrestle with it, but I only use it for what it's for what I need it for. It doesn't become my life. People are becoming hooked into robots, aren't they?
Well, some people enjoy it, I guess.
I know.
The trouble with this qualification bandwagon, which has existed for many, many years now, is it ain't going to go away. You know, we've got to learn to live with it, because the job market is way more focused and competitive than it ever was before. And the more qualifications you have, the better edge you have in the competition. So there'll be more of them, not less in the future.
In a few moments, Jane, we'll be speaking to the director of the National Apprenticeship Service, Sue Husband, who will be joining us together with Joe Billington from the National Careers Service, and they'll be sharing their sort of thoughts on the whole thing. But it's almost a mini industry in itself, though, isn't it? The kind of the subsection of support services that support the examination structures. It's almost as though we want to assess the assessors and then assess the assessors for assessing the assessors.
It's who guards the guards.
Exactly. Quis custodiet ipsos custodies, which is a piece of Latin, I'm sure. You never actually want to use it in any of your texts or plays, Arthur. But I'm sure you
don't even know what it means. Well,
there we are.
In fact, we were given a Latin in school, and I don't know why.
Well, look, a Latin Geordie, that's really the ultimate scenario, hasn't it? Cogito ergo sum, pet. That's the whole classic line there. In fact, you might like to use that as a little title. Arthur, what are you doing at present? Because obviously we followed you through Harrigan, the making of the motion picture, and all the rest of the bits and pieces. What do your current writing geniuses work?
Two or three things on the go. With probably the most interesting one at the moment is I'm writing a piece about a seagull, which wakes up in the morning and it's on its way to the Newcastle Sunderland Derby.
Is it an insane seagull? Is it going to a seagull asylum? You know, the seagull who goes to... and is it St James Park or is it Roker Park?
Well, it goes to St James's Park and he suddenly realises it's an away game and he has to go down to Sunderland. But he's on the search for pizzas, pies and fish and chips. And what he does is he just tells a story in verse about all the characters he sees and the landscape and... It's set up as not just as a piece of prose, but it's also, hopefully, we're going to get it put through as an animation.
Well, I think that sounds very timely, because seagulls are much maligned at the moment.
I mean, I've been fighting the case of Jonathan Livingston seagull for quite some time, and he's had a bit of a... He's basically a bit like the royal family earlier. He's having a bad year in terms of seagulls. You know, they're almost like miniature pterodactyls.
Well, also, it would be good to have another seagull story. I mean, Jonathan Livingston seagull is tremendous, but we could do with more than one.
Here we are. And a Geordie seagull to boot pet.
Yes.
In terms of the, I mean, I hate to mention the word, Mark, because presumably it'll be for a family audience, but will you be looking at youngsters? Because it did seem it's a bit of a departure, Arthur, from your normal hard-hitting crime-based material.
Well, not really. People just think that's all I write. I've written a musical. I've done all sorts of stuff. People pigeonhole you, see? This is what happens, isn't it?
Yes.
Because I'm an ex-cop, etc., and that's what the advice I was giving somebody else there, I did what I did best, and I did the best I could with it. But I have done lots of other stuff, and I do write poetry and stuff like that. So I'm not just a one-trick pony, I don't think.
Well, the trouble is, you know, when you do something successful in these kind of fields, people just want more of the same.
That's
and
right.
They can't see any alternatives. No. I think actors have this same problem, don't they?
And
absolutely.
From your own point of view, Jane, you know, Channel 4 utilise your good self then, Channel 5, and it's all royal material. You've done other things other than the royals, of course.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's just a sideshow, really. But it's becoming that way for me with comics and cartoons. And, you know, two books out this month. And I suspect that people will want more of the same. And unfortunately,
it's Jane
sometimes
Chapman,
happens.
Comic Girl.
Yes, Jane at War.
Precisely. Still, you know, it could have gone the way of the Daily Mirror Jane, a cartoon, which would be a different Jane entirely.
Well,
still,
she did go on for a while after
course,
the war.
Exactly.
And then she walked into the sunset with her husband, didn't
well,
she?
Well, precisely. And that is the message that we have to take with us fondly into the whole system. Arthur, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on
yes,
the programme today?
Absolutely.
Are you back with us again next week?
Well, if you want this, yes.
Yes, of course.
With lashings of country
news. I'll give you a bit of the seagull prose next week.
The midweek drive on Siren 107.3 FM.
Ah, there we are. More prose coming up in its own magical way. Tears for Fears up now, and then the National Career Service. Sentiments you may well echo as we continue through A-Level Results Day. Well, we've already had some interesting words of advice from Arthur McKenzie, from Richard Fitzwilliams indirectly, of course from Gabriella Peralta and Professor Jane Chapman, who's in the studio with us. We're delighted now to be able to welcome to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition the Director of the National Apprenticeship Service, Sue Husband. Good morning, Sue. How are you?
Good morning, Alex. I'm well, thank you.
Very good to speak to you as ever. And also from the National Career Service, Joe Billington. How are you, Joe?
I'm very well, thank you very much, Alex.
Excellent. Sue, if we can come to you first and foremost, the National Apprenticeship Service. There are folk today who might have got better than expected results. They might have got the results they were expecting. Who knows? There's a whole continuum of examination results out there. How can the National Apprenticeship Service be a very valid and viable option for folk?
Well, I think the first thing I'd say is that obviously for young people today is not to worry. So whatever your results are, it's important that you have all the information you need to make a good decision for you. And the National Apprenticeship Service can help by giving you all the information you'd need about the opportunities that are available in apprentices. And we have apprenticeships now spanning 170 industries. There are over 1,500 job roles. So if you're getting your results today and you're thinking about doing an apprenticeship, then we can help. The first thing I'd say to young people is go to gov.uk and search apprenticeships. And you can actually hear from some people who are doing an apprenticeship and, you know, hear why they're enjoying it so much.
And as I said before, Sue, of course, it's not mutually exclusive. You can come to higher education, university, after you've done your apprenticeship. You can combine them. There are indeed apprenticeships that actually combine degree courses as well, I believe.
No, absolutely, Alex. And I think that's the beauty now is that, you know, and we see that young people are undertaking apprenticeships and getting in with a business and being able to go far. So 90% of apprentices stay in employment after finishing their apprenticeship, and two-thirds of them stay with the same employer. But we also see people doing an apprenticeship and then going back into full-time education. So it's really just about continuing your learning throughout your life.
Professor Jane Chapman, you used to, of course, be admissions tutor for the postgraduate programme as far as the School of English and Media is concerned, or English and Journalism at the school, right? We change so often. From your own perspective, does what Sue's been saying resonate in terms of where people should be thinking about going and so on?
Absolutely. I mean, I think Sue's right in basically there's a lot more flexibility these days than there used to be. So it doesn't have to be all education, then all work, or all work and then education. You can mix and match. And it's worth doing research to find out what's available. What I found with the master's people is career development loans were their salvation.
Joe Billington from the National Career Service. We were talking earlier about the infrastructure that seems to be growing like Topsy year in, year out. But you do such an excellent job. You've been listening to, obviously, the discussion so far. Any sort of aspects you'd like to add from the point of view of people's careers? Because so much pressure seems to be there on folks saying, you've got to do this, you've got to do this. Maybe sometimes it's best to take a year out and do something, you know, other than the sort of area you first intended to go into.
Well, I think I'd echo some of the things that have already been said, that it's important to stay calm and to make a calm and careful decision about your future. If that means taking a year off to consider your options, then by all means do that. But certainly, if you want to make a decision now, then make sure you've done the research, had some thoughts about where it is you want to go, and done some research as to how you're going to get there. And that's where the National Career Service can help. If you go to our website, you'll find there's 800 job profiles on there describing the different sorts of roles there are out there in different types of industries, and the sorts of skills, qualifications, and experience you're going to need to get to where you want to go. And that will help you make the decisions in the short term as to where you're going to go in that short term. So have a look at our website, or indeed you can speak to one of our advisors on 0800 100 900, and they can help you interpret your results, think about your experience, think about all those things you've been doing over those last few years at school, and to use that to support your thinking about where you're going to go in the future.
Perhaps returning to something that Sue actually said, the important thing is not to panic and to hopefully also avoid the notion that, as the old Buddhist saying goes, where there is choice, there is misery, because there does seem to be such a plethora of choice these days. I mean, obviously, National Career Service, National Apprenticeship Service, degrees, universities, etc. Sometimes you have to go and listen to that inner voice, would you say?
I think absolutely that's right. You certainly need to make some... spend some time thinking about what it is that you want to do. And the National Career Service might be the first best place to go, because their intention there is to consider all of those different options, to think about apprenticeships, to think about degrees, to think about some of those mix and match that we've also been talking about, and to spend the time considering what it is that you want to do. What skills have you got? What attitudes do you have? What aptitudes do you have? Where is it that you want to go in the longer term? And the National Career Service will help you think about that sort of stuff, to listen, to, as you say, to that inner voice.
Jane, any thoughts you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, I'd also think don't always go for the obvious. You know, not everybody can be a celebrity. Not everybody can be a professional musician or actor. You know, there are a lot of football player, but there are a lot of lesser known vocations, jobs, careers that are really interesting and challenging. So I think cast the net widely and be flexible in your thinking.
And back to Sue again from the National Apprenticeship Service. Again, presumably that resonates with the advice you would actually provide in terms of how apprenticeships, which a few years ago seemed to be so out of fashion, and, you know, people used to mourn the lack of apprenticeships. People, you know, back end of the 20th century would say there's no apprenticeship. And they've just come back, you know, in full force, it would seem, Sue, really for all occupations, as we've said.
Yeah, and I think there's many reasons for that. Apprenticeships deliver not just for the young people that do them, but also for, you know, the employers that are employing them. So I think that's why they're raising in popularity. And there's over 240,000 workplaces now who currently employ apprentices. There are, if you go right now on to Find an Apprenticeship, which is the website where you can actually apply for one, and there are up to 27,000 apprenticeship vacancies available. And as I said, they're available in 170 industries and there are 1,500 job roles. So it really is worth doing a bit of investigation. The other thing I would say is to involve your parents. And those around you in that decision making, so that you're all, you know, you're really well informed and you're getting the best advice from all the different places that you can possibly get it from.
Makes perfect sense. So many little contact details. We will be putting this up as a podcast very shortly, so you can always listen again to the whole piece advice and things that are working through that. But very briefly, presumably you can use search engines to find the National Apprenticeship Service for yourself, Sue.
Yeah, so go to gov.uk and just simply search apprenticeship.
And Joe, from the point of view of the National Career Service, likewise, you can, of course, use the number 0800 100 900, but also you can use the various search engines to check out National Career Service as well.
Indeed, National Career Service in any search engine will come to the top of the list.
Well, I would expect no better. And just from the point of view of observations, I mean, are the telephone lines going crazy? I mean, from the point of view of your staff and folk who are actually there? Because, I mean, we're approaching that time where obviously people are still going into school to actually collect their results, etc. They haven't quite released it online and so on. Do you expect to see a peak around about 10:30 or 11 o'clock-ish, or will it be even now getting very... sort of major lines on telephones? Because I know at the University of Lincoln here we have our clearing team all set up and ready to go, and they're taking your calls.
And I wanted to make a plea for universities as well. We talk about apprenticeships and career, but it doesn't matter if you don't have your career set. If you go to university and you study a subject that interests you and you're passionate about it, you've got time to decide what to do, and it's a lot of fun, and you develop as a person and you develop your own curiosity. And I think there's a lot of good reasons for going to university, not just economic. You know, the maybe the level at which you go into a job would be higher afterwards as a graduate, because graduate earnings are higher than non-graduate. But it's not just economic. It's to do with your own development and your own life and growing as a person and having a lot of fun and going through that stage of discovery and buying time as well.
Which hopefully, Sue and Joe, you both agree with as well, because I'd like to actually end on a positive note, which is all very good.
Yes, and I'd say it wholeheartedly. I think the key thing here is it's about the young people and them having all the information they need to make the right decision for them. And for some, that will absolutely be university. And for others, I'm pleased to say that will be the apprenticeship route, where they can get into a business and go far and actually end up possibly doing a degree apprenticeship. So I think key thing is choice.
And that's exactly the kind of advice that the National Career Service would offer as well, in terms of thinking about what your learning styles are, what it is you want to do in the longer term, and whether therefore university or an apprenticeship or some other route might be the best choice for you.
It's been a perfect win-win situation all round. Joe Billington from the National Career Service and Sue Husband, Director of the National Apprenticeship Service, thank you. We've got the news coming up in a few seconds from now on Siren 107.3 FM. Many thanks. We'll speak again very soon. Take care now.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hello, this is Jane Clark, the historian at Aintree Racecourse, and you're listening to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition with Alex Leftchuk.
Excellent. Thank you, Jane. From Jane Clark to Jane Chapman. You see the magic works through.
Do you know that Clark is my married name?
Well,
but is it with an E?
It is, actually, yes.
Well, there we are.
Yes,
yeah, so yeah. I call myself Chapman Clark for my bank account.
It's a win-win situation. Yes. We must give the weather forecast. We heard it at the back end of the news there, of course. High today, 19 degrees centigrade, lows of 15 degrees. degrees centigrade, mainly dry through the morning, but with outbreaks of rain in the afternoon, as far as Lincoln's concerned.
So we've had it quite nice up to now, haven't
exactly,
we, this week?
Exactly. Yes. I would say we've never had it so good, because that was a political statement back in the day, really, Harold Macmillan. But we have, before you actually leave us today, Jane, got to address a couple of key issues. We talked, obviously, about your upcoming Channel 5 documentary. We're a consultant with respect to that in terms of the press and the royal family. But
two documentaries.
Two documentaries.
A series.
I see it like a bit like Lord of the Rings, really. You could break it up into various segments. Exactly. Two documentaries.
And it's coinciding with the Queen's 90th birthday.
Absolutely. But in addition to that, this very month, not one, but two books are out and available. So let's share with the audience.
Yes, that's right. These two books are the fruits of a four-year research project where we have been looking at comics and the World Wars and how historians can use comics as a record of what was happening. Comics produced mainly at the time, I have to say, as a cultural record.
It's a wonderful snapshot, of course. One of our other regular Midweek Drivettes, Andy Kerr.
Yes, he's one of my team.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. I work well with Andy. In fact, we did some joint teaching on the public relations programme last year, so great stuff on that. I know he was totally enthused by the whole package. We talked with Richard Fitzwilliams in the first hour of the programme about the wonderful exhibition you had at the Cartoon Museum, the Comic Museum.
Yes, we've had two exhibitions there. One of them was only just finished, called Heckling Hitler. Oh. See, there are lots of other contributors.
The royal we.
Collective. And the other one was last year, and it was called Never Again, and it was on the First World War, and it was cartoons and comics from the First World War. And we made a substantial contributions.
And there are so many fascinating...
And we're in partnership with the Cartoon Museum for this research grant.
And there are so many fascinating connections within that whole package that actually you tend to think, oh, comics, etc. But the levels at which they're developed in terms of people in the troops actually sort of writing their own gallows humour, strip cartoons, very much the text messages of the day, really, I say. Messages and Facebook and things.
Yes, that's right. I mean, people love to record things. There's something that is often forgotten. In wartime, take the First World War, the men in the trenches had a lot of spare time on their hands. They actually were only in the front line for a quarter of their time, and they moved into other positions and had time off. And during that time off, you know, there was no TV or even radio, they would write things down. They would write notes, they would write poetry, they would draw. And it's that record that we've recuperated. And it's been a real discovery. Andy, for instance, in our team, has recently discovered 34 cartoons done during the First World War by a German prisoner of war of a camp in South Lincolnshire, Long Sutton. And they're tremendous. Some of them are in colour, and they tell us a lot about life in that prisoner of war camp during the First World War.
And my own personal favourites, of course, the comics as propaganda elements, certainly in terms of American comics and the whole sort of timely characters and so on. Invaders and Superman, Batman, etc., the way they were actually used in wartime, I think, were quite
useful. They changed. Yeah. Yes, they changed during war. They changed for the war effort.
How can people get hold of these wonderful texts? Presumably they're available online and so on?
Yes, the publishers are Palgrave Macmillan. Uh-huh. And the first one is called Comics and the World Wars, A Cultural Record. And the second one is called Comics, Hiroshima and Holocaust. And that's specifically about comics for on those events.
And certainly very timely in terms of the recent 70th anniversary of course, the
absolutely,
bombings in
yes.
Hiroshima and Nagasaki, of course, which was 70 years and 1 week since the first atomic bomb was dropped, which I suppose, in a real sense, puts everything into perspective. We've talked today on the programme about the Royal Yacht Britannia, Gibraltarian politics, and indeed the ongoing scenario of careers and A-level results, etc. Maybe it's important that we just keep on treating each other as human beings, fundamentally.
Well, maybe it's important we put peace first.
Absolutely.
Yes, as the Japanese told us last week.
I've just seen a wonderful sort of line on Facebook which suggests that we should really call on the Buddhists to actually break out a whole new peace format for the Western world because we're in need of it. Which is the way forward.
That
Jane,
sounds...
Have you enjoyed your time on the programme today?
Yes, I have, Alex. Yeah.
And you will be returning?
I'd love to.
Hurrah!